Joe, for short, burbled happily up at his daddy from his car seat.
You ready for more family, little man?
His toothless, cheerful son slobbered out a happy reply as Gibson unhooked him and picked him up. Want some help wrapping him up? Callie offered. She'd changed her hair again, this time going for a soft, silvery blonde that hung to her shoulders. Gibson knew from first-hand experience how spectacular it looked fanned out on the rug in front of the fireplace.
Just shove his feet through, he said, putting on the baby carrier. I'll wear him until the kids and dogs calm down a bit.
Good thinking, she said, tucking their son's chubby little legs through the carrier. Callie picked up the diaper bag and tote of presents. Together, with their treasures, they trooped through the snow in boots and plaid pajama pants toward the house. The kids had already raced inside and were ooing and aahing over the tree, the presents, and the hot chocolate.
Merry Christmas,
Devlin greeted them on the front porch, holding two travel mugs of coffee. Always just a shade too fancy for Bootleg Springs, he'd topped his fleece Santa pants with a navy sweater. It was part of Judge McAllister's charm, Gibson supposed.
Merry Christmas, Dev,
Callie said, giving her brother-in-law a smacking kiss on the cheek. Did you see which way the rest of my small army went? Their host tilted his head in the direction of the tree.
I believe they are engaging their cousins in an epic game of Guess What's in This Box. Spoiler alert, no matter what anyone says, it's not a pony.
Grinning, Callie went inside to ensure order was reasonably observed. With an 8-year-old, a 7-year-old, a 5-year-old, and now Joe, order had become a relative term in their home.
Have a sec? Devlin asked Gibson. All the time in the world.
Scarlett's having feelings today.
Oh, boy.
She's down on the dock, taking a minute. It's Bodine-related, so I thought you'd be a better ear than me.
I'll take care of it, Gibson said.
These are for you and her, Devlin said, handing over the mugs.
And this is for her.
He slipped a candy bar in the pocket of Gibson's flannel coat, then gave Joe's nose a boop and tickled under his chin.
Want me to take Joe?
Nah,
he'll soften her up, Gibson predicted. We'll be in soon.
He stepped off the porch and followed the path that carved its way through the snow-covered yard in the direction of the lake. Steam rose from the dark waters. Evergreens drooped under the weight of the white. The sky was a flawless, cloudless powder blue. The warm, loving chaos of family behind him and the pristine quiet of nature ahead of him. The perfect West Virginia Christmas. He found his sister perched on the edge of the dock. Her legs, clad in elf print pants, swung back and forth above the water.
Don't you come a step closer, she said without turning around.
He could hear the tears in her voice.
Ah, hell.
He hated tears. Ignoring her warning, he strolled up to her and handed the coffee over her shoulder.
Thanks, Gibbs, she sniffled.
How'd you know it was me?
Your footsteps sounded grumpy.
Who's grumpy on Christmas?
He asked, carefully settling down next to her. Joe cooed and reached toward the endless stretch of lake in front of them. Scarlett swiped her sleeve under her nose.
I'm not sad, just so you know.
Mad?
She shook her head, and he noticed the pointer finger of her left hand was tracing the words carved into the wood. The Bodines had built this dock together the summer the house was complete. They launched decks and boats and kayaks, enjoyed picnics, sang songs, threw each other in the lake, all from this stretch of wood. In homage to their past and present, they'd carved the names of every single family member, pets included, into the wood. Jonah and Connie Bodine. They got top billing on the very last board. Scarlett's gloved finger traced the letters over and over again.
Overwhelmed? Gibson guessed.
Scarlett shot him a suspicious glance. It would seem that having a wife and two daughters has turned you into the female perspective.
It would seem,
he agreed, tickling Joe's socked feet.
Thinking about Mom and Dad?
She nodded, sipped the coffee, and stared out at the water.
We're so fucking lucky, Gibbs. You, me, Callie, Bowie and Cass, Jonah and Shelby, Jameson and Leah May, Junie and George. Sometimes it just swells up inside me until I could just burst. Then I think how none of this would be possible if it weren't for them. How it wouldn't be this good if they were still here.
Her voice broke a little on her confession. Gibson wisely remained silent. He stroked a hand over her back. His sister's biggest problem had always been how big she loved. It was his favorite thing about her.
They did the best they could, he murmured.
Becoming a father had given him a new and terrifying perspective on how damn hard raising human beings was. Even though he had a loving partner and had managed to make peace with his demons, being on, being good, staying focused on what was best for them all was fucking monumentally exhausting.
I know they did,
Scarlett said, wiping her nose with her other sleeve.
Just like I know we're going to do a hell of a lot better by our kids and our partners. I wish I could just say thank you for giving us this life.
You can. I don't know if they'll hear you, but there's nothing wrong with carrying a little gratitude around in your heart.
She snorted.
All right now, who are you and what the hell did you do with my brother?
He bumped her shoulder with his.
Let's chalk it up to a Christmas miracle. I promise to go back to calling everyone names and kicking puppies tomorrow.
Maybe you're feeling a little grateful yourself, Scarlett mused.
Maybe I am. You're the best sister I could have ever asked for, Scar,
he said, surprising them both.
Damn it, Gibbs. Don't you go and say stupid things like that when I'm trying to compose myself, she wailed.
Joe rewarded his emotional aunt a baby belly laugh. Gibson's throat tickled a little again, and he cleared it gruffly.
You know that you're the reason I am who I am, don't you? She said. Mom and Dad may have put us here, but you made me who I am. You raised me right, Gibbs, and you're doing an amazing job with those four little ones.
Now there was something blurring up his eyes.
Must be a fog rolling in,
he decided and wiped at the corner of his leaky eye.
There's something else, she announced in a rush.
Oh, hell, Scarlett. You didn't up and murder someone, did you? Shit. Misty Lynn didn't give up her job singing at that diner in Kentucky and come home, did she? Where's the body? Do we really want to put the next generation of Bodines through that?
Scarlett punched him in the shoulder just like he'd hoped.
I didn't kill anyone. Though if that Misty Lynn thinks she can show up here today with Jenny and Jimmy Bob for lunch, she's got another thing coming. I ain't afraid to defend my home from a garbage bag human being like her.
So what is it then?
It's about the next generation. I'm pregnant.
No shit.
All natural and accidental this time, just like Mom and Dad. Haven't even worked up the nerve to tell Dev yet.
Scarlett and Devlin's twins had taken a lot of trying and some science. They'd made an adventure out of it, and in the end, they'd gotten there happily ever after with two tomboys who kept them on their toes. Gibson hoped for a boy, a calm one.
Scar, he's going to be over the moon.
Oh, I know, but I don't want to just blurt it out like I do everything else. I want to make it special.
You'll figure it out.
If you tell him I told you first, I'll call you a dirty liar and insist on cooking y'all dinner.
Gibson laughed softly.
I love you, Scar.
Love you too, Bodine.
Her hand rested on her belly, a soft smile curving the corners of her lips.
Merry Christmas, Bodines!
Gibson raised a hand to the occupants of the canoe that paddled by. Santa was at the helm. Mrs. Claus held up a set of jingle bells. Scarlet blew them a kiss.
Merry Christmas, y'all!
They watched until Santa disappeared. Only in Bootleg Springs.
Ready to go back in?
Yeah. The ratio of grown-ups to kids in there is a little scary right now before all the grandparents roll in for lunch.
They climbed to their feet and Scarlet gave Joe a quick snuggle.
Bet the tree's been pulled down by a kid or dog and one of the cousins accidentally punched another one in the face.
That's how Jackson lost his first tooth,
Gibson recalled fondly.
My dear sweet Calla didn't mean to knock his tooth out, Scarlet argued. She was merely putting on a sweatshirt, and he stood too close.
He put his arm around her shoulders and gave her a squeeze.
It's a good life, isn't it?
The best.
Here, something to make it even sweeter,
he said, handing over the candy bar.
That Devlin, Scarlet said, ripping off the wrapper. I swear that man knows me better than I know myself.
He's too good for us,
Gibson agreed.
Let's hope he never figures out that fact, Scarlet said, taking a bite of chocolate and nougat.
Better?
Perfect. Now give me your baby, Gibbs. I need to practice.
Gibson deftly freed Baby Joe from the carrier. By his fourth baby, he was nothing if not experienced, and handed him to Scarlet. Joe squealed, and Scarlet gave him a kiss on the forehead. Inside, in the warmth and chaos of the great room, they found Gibson's older three at the large dining table custom built to fit their growing family. The kids were happily dunking marshmallows into mugs of hot chocolate with their cousins. The dogs, bored with chasing Jedediah the cat, lurked nearby, ready to snatch up any dropped morsels. Bowie and Cassidy's 6-year-old daughter, a pretty little thing with the dark Bodine hair and the Tucker nose, sat next to Scarlet and Devlin's pigtailed twins, arguing about whether or not the table was level. Scarlet and Cassidy had been pregnant together, completing their lifelong dreams of sisterhood. Jonah and Shelby's two kids, they'd adopted a girl, then, a few years later, a boy, were on the other side of the table, stirring candy canes into their mugs of cocoa and eyeing the excitement of the younger cousins with amusement. Jameson and Leah May's two girls, ages 4 and 2, shared their daddy's lap at the table. They both wore princess dresses over their pajama pants and had sparkly pink crowns on their heads. A very pregnant Leah May, due with their first boy just after the new year, lounged on the couch with her feet up.
Merry Christmas, George called to Gibson.
He and June stood near the fireplace. Their sports-obsessed daughter, a given thanks to her parents' interests, was busy showing off her new hockey jersey to Uncle Jonah. Their son was tucked quietly in a corner of the couch under a blanket with a book and a headlamp. Gibson caught Devlin's eye and gave him a reassuring nod. His brother-in-law raised his morning beer in thanks.
All right, y'all, who wants to open presents? Scarlet demanded, raising her voice to be heard above the din. Me!
Every one of the kids seemed to shout at once. It sounded like a herd of elephants knocking over a room full of furniture as all the kids scrambled out of their chairs and into the living room. Devlin and Bowie masterfully corralled the cousins and their volcanic excitement, placing them in a half circle on the floor in front of the huge Christmas tree. Jonah joined them, and the three donned red Santa hats to do the honors. Years ago, when the family had been smaller, they'd all taken turns playing Santa. Now that there were 13 kids, and counting, Santa needed some extra helpers when it came time to open presents. The kids tore into their packages, flinging bows and wrapping paper everywhere. In no time flat, the living room looked like it had been hit by a Christmas tornado. Jameson sat on the floor with his girls, helping the youngest get the ribbon off her package while her older sister hung on his back. Jonah and Shelby's son dutifully collected discarded paper and bags while his sister helped the littles unbox treasures. George darted in to break up an impromptu and giggly wrestling match that broke out between his daughter and one of Scarlet's girls a second before they rolled into the 12-foot white pine tree. It had been knocked over on two separate occasions. Gibson leaned against the kitchen island and sipped his coffee. The giggles and squeals from all the kids nearly drowned out the Christmas music playing in the background. The house smelled of that magic formula of pine, chocolate, fresh coffee, and cranberry orange muffins Millie Waggle Newsome and her husband had dropped off earlier that morning. He felt a tug on his sleeve and looked down. His oldest, 8-year-old Jackson, held up a shoebox-sized package that he'd clearly wrapped himself in pink paper left over from his sister's last birthday.
"What's this, buddy?"
Gibson asked, taking the present.
"It's for you."
Gibson felt the weight of it and eyed his son with curiosity. He'd gotten used to kid gifts. Flowers picked on hikes, rocks fished out of the lake, scribbly pictures that held places of honor on the refrigerator or the big bulletin board they'd put up in the dining room of the new house they'd built on Bodine Land. Then there were the presents obviously chosen by Callie for Father's Day or his birthday. But he could tell this was different. Jackson looked up at him with big blue eyes full of hopeful expectation.
So much like his mother.
Carefully, Gibson popped the two pieces of scotch tape Jackson had used to secure the box. Inside, he found what looked like a big lump of hard clay surrounded by wadded-up newspaper. Taking it out, he turned it over. He could make out ears and a nose, four legs with big paws, a tail, and just one eye.
"I made it for you," Jackson said. "Uncle Jameson helped a little."
"This is cash?" Gibson asked.
"Yeah,"
Jackson nodded enthusiastically.
"Do you like it?"
Gibson crouched down so he could look his son in the eyes.
"Buddy, I love it. I'll put them in my workshop so I can look at them every day."
The smile on his son's face lit up the world. He wrapped his arms around Gibson's neck.
"Merry Christmas, Daddy."
"Merry Christmas, son,"
Gibson said, hugging his boy maybe just a shade too tight.
"I love you."
Jackson planted a loud kiss on his cheek.
"Love you too."
He wriggled free and ran off to join his cousins in playing with their new toys. Gibson stood and Jameson caught his eye. He held up the clay dog and Jameson raised his beer. They shared a smile and a nod that made Gibson's throat feel thick again. He turned and coughed into his fist. The whole damn family was choking him up today. Callie sidled up to him, baby free for the moment. Bowie had snatched Joe from Scarlet, and he and Cassidy were making him belly laugh with a game of peekaboo.
"What did Jack give you?"
she asked. "He insisted on doing everything himself. Wouldn't even let me help wrap it." Gibson held up the dog his son had sculpted.
"He made cash."
"Oh my God, that's so freaking cute," Callie said.
"It's not just cute. It's fucking precious,"
Gibson said, setting it down reverently on the island. Callie laughed and wrapped her arms around his waist.
"Family gossip. Cass and Beau are thinking about another kid."
"Yeah?"
he asked, glancing at his brother, currently making goofy faces at baby Joe.
"About time."
"Cassidy was asking me about having multiple kids, and Bowie was asking Jonah about adoption,"
Callie said. "They're worried about messing up their family dynamic. Ava is basically the easiest child on the planet. I think they're afraid if they have another one, he or she might be like..."
"Like Scarlet,"
Gibson said with a laugh.
"Or you," Callie said, squeezing him.
"That would be a disaster,"
he said.
"Thankfully, ours all take after their mama."
"I don't know. That little one could go either way yet," Callie said.
Gibson chuckled. Baby Joe had been a bit of a surprise, but he couldn't imagine life without his little man. Hell, he couldn't imagine life without any of them. His two sons,
his two sweet girls, his beautiful wife, their dogs. Family was everything. And part of him felt a deep sorrow that Jonah and Connie Bodine never grasped that truth. "What's going on out there?" Callie asked, nodding toward the deck doors. Scarlett and Devlin were outside having what appeared to be a very animated conversation. "They aren't fighting, are they?" Callie asked.
"Nah, they ain't fighting," Gibson said. "Scar hadn't tried to bite him yet."
Gibson watched as Devlin grabbed Scarlett, picking her up off her feet and twirled her around. Scarlett threw her head back, her dark hair streaming out behind her, an expression of pure joy lighting up her face. "Looks like something good," Callie said. "Maybe she just told him what she got him for Christmas." He pulled his wife in closer and took a deep breath, inhaling her scent.
"I bet it's something like that."
Devlin burst inside, dragging a laughing Scarlett by the hand.
"Y'all, we're pregnant," he shouted over the noise.
The house went quiet like a record scratch.
"And Devlin said, y'all, Scarlett added.
A new level of chaos exploded. Scarlett and Devlin's twins hurled themselves off the coffee table and into their parents' arms. Cassidy, impatient with the family hug, shoved a twin out of the way and grabbed Scarlett in a tearful embrace. Devlin juggled both girls and the congratulations of the entire rest of the family. The kids, sensing relaxed disciplinarians, tackled Devlin to the floor in an aggressive celebration. Gibson caught Scarlett's eye when Cassidy finally let her go and winked. Someone called for a toast, and in seconds, Jameson and Jonah were in the kitchen, popping the corks off champagne bottles.
"I sure love that noise," Scarlett chirped. "Nothing says celebration like a champagne bottle popping."
"You may listen, but you may not partake," June said sternly. Bowie lined up juice glasses for the kids, as well as Gibson, Leah May, and Scarlett. Once drinks were distributed, Devlin held up his glass.
"To Scarlett Bodine McAllister for making my life one miracle after another."
The collective awe came from the women in the room.
"To Scarlett," the crowd of them said together.
"That was a nice sentiment," June said. "I would like to go read now."
George held up a sparkly gift bag with festive piglets on it.
"Got you covered, Junebug."
"Christmas pigs and a sports biography," June nodded her appreciation. "You excel at being a husband."
"Y'all, I've got something to say, too,"
Gibson said, clearing that dang tight throat again. Cash and Potato trotted over and sat at his feet, looking up at him, tails wagging. Callie's eyes sparkled at him and made him feel like he could probably get the words out.
"All right. Christmas isn't a bad time to stop for a minute and look around at what we have. It doesn't seem so long ago that this family was a lot smaller. Maybe we ain't perfect. It's only a matter of time before one of the dogs chases Scarlett's cat and knocks over the tree, or the kids try to sled down the stairs on sleeping bags, or someone starts a food fight. Kids, maybe keep it to marshmallows this year. If y'all are going to throw Jell-O again, take it outside."
The kids giggled. Last year's Jell-O fight had been epic, but a hell of a mess to clean up afterward.
"My guess, what I'm saying is, we have a damn good family. And the fact that it keeps right on growing," he said, nodding to Scarlett and Leah May, "makes it that much better. Things could have turned out a lot different for all of us. Not a day goes by that I don't think about how lucky we are."
He had to stop for a second because his damn throat was closing up again. He took a quick breath and raised his cup.
"To us. Merry Christmas, y'all," Gibson said, his voice cracking just enough that Callie launched herself into his arms, spilling her champagne and his apple juice.
"To us, Merry Christmas," rose the chorus of voices.
"The grandmas and grandpas are here,"
Scarlett's twins reported, peering through binoculars from the landing on the staircase.
Oh, Lord, I haven't even got the picking food out yet, Scarlet yelped. Scarlet, you didn't cook, did you? Leah May asked as Shelby hauled her to her feet to greet the new arrivals. Shelby did the cooking, but I swear I helped, and I didn't burn a damn thing, Scarlet shot back.
She burned 6 dozen sugar cookies, Shelby reported under her breath. The fire department was on standby.
The grandmas and grandpas and nanas and pappies funneled through the front door in a seemingly endless procession. Jenny and Jimmy Bob, Harlan and Nadine, Granny Louisa and Estelle arrived with Gram Gram, James and Darlene Thompson, the McAllisters, Clay and Betsy Larkin, all arrived with covered dishes and even more gifts.
You're going to need a bigger house if this family keeps growing, Jonah told Scarlet before swooping in to give his mother a peck on the cheek.
Let me at those grandbabies, Jenny said.
They produced appetizers, popped more champagne, and generally sprawled out to catch up. Everyone ate and drank, talked and laughed. The kids played. Jedediah the cat hissed from his perch 6 feet up the tree. Potato and Billy Ray got in a tug-of-war over a dog toy, while Catherine the pot-bellied pig shoved her snout under the blanket where June cuddled with her son and their books. Scarlet and Devlin's girls tried to wrap their Uncle Jonah with the discarded wrapping paper. He pretended to break free with a big roar, earning the squeals and screams from the kids. The dogs barked and yipped, joining the delighted celebration. Jenny and Jimmy Bob arrived with more food and were almost knocked over by the horde of happy kids looking for Christmas hugs from Grandma Jenny and Grandpa Jimmy Bob.
When is Jamie getting in? Bowie asked.
She and her wife are en route, Cassidy reported. They'll be here with their daughter in time for lunch. They had breakfast with their folks this morning.
Hey, y'all, we still need to do the bootleg swindle, Cassidy called.
The gift exchange had become a Bodine, McAllister, Thompson family tradition. It had started simply enough as a white elephant gag gift exchange, but in true Bodine fashion, it had morphed into something more complicated and rowdier. Bowie had been the genius to introduce the red poker chip. Whoever found the red poker chip in their package got a crisp $100 bill. To even it out, they also got dunked in the lake. To make it fair, Jenny did the honors of placing the poker chip in one of the packages ahead of time so no one would know where it was. Unlike the rest of the family, she was uncorruptible. They'd all tried to bribe or threaten, but the stubbornness in the family wasn't relegated to only the Bodine side of things.
Okay, but I don't want to go first, George said.
He had a knack for picking the poker chip. He'd gotten it 3 times, a family record. Luckily, he was a good sport and jumped off the dock rather than making everyone try to lift him. With reluctance and excitement, they all drew numbers, and the swap began with enthusiasm. Packages were chosen and swapped. Some were stolen when their owners weren't watching. It was all part of the swindle.
Ready?
Devlin asked once everyone had a present. Anticipation crackled in the air. The gifts were often odd, silly, homemade, or most often legitimately terrible, like the singing fish Gibson had gotten a few years ago. But the real question was always who would wind up with the poker chip.
Go!
Devlin and Scarlet shouted together. The adults tore into their gifts with as much gusto as the kids. Callie held baby Joe on her hip while the older three peered over the back of the couch, hoping one of their parents would get the poker chip.
I am not the loser, June declared, holding up an XXL sweatshirt that said, Moonshine Mama.
Callie dumped the contents of her gift, a battery-operated fly swatter and a pack of baby wipes, on the coffee table and let out a sigh of relief.
Not it.
More not me's filled the air as gift after gift was unveiled. Gibson's daughters, too excited to wait any longer, jumped in to help him rip open his present.
Daddy got the chip! Daddy got the chip! They cried.
Gibson let out a long breath and held the red poker chip between his thumb and forefinger.
Shit.
Daddy said shit! Get the prisoner!
Scarlet's twins yelled simultaneously, swooping in with a length of pink rope and a roll of scotch tape. Gibson dropped the chip and nimbly darted through the kitchen and out the door. Cash and Potato tore after him, barking up a storm. Billy Ray and the Bodine brothers gave chase, but Jonah was faster. He tackled Gibson headlong in the snow.
"Don't fight it, Gibbs," Bowie said, taking hold of one of his arms. "It's just has to happen."
"It's how we do things," Devlin said, clearly enjoying himself. He took a leg. Jameson and Jonah got his other limbs. George and the twins were there in case Gibson needed further restraint.
"Oh, hell, guys, it's freezing out," Gibson said. "How about a rain check? Y'all can dunk me twice next summer."
"Not a chance, Bodine," Callie laughed. "You're going in the drink."
He growled at his wife, mostly for show, and she gave him a smug smile.
"This is a stupid family tradition," Gibson yelled.
"Uncle Gibbs said stupid," Ava sang.
The rest of the kids oohed their disapproval. Gibson didn't resist much as his brothers hauled him down the path to the dock. Everyone followed, from the humans and pets alike, all chanting, "Dunk him! Dunk him! Dunk him!" in unison. They took him to the edge of the dock and, wasting no time, threw him into the water. He plunged beneath the surface, thankful the hot springs kept the lake lukewarm, even in the winter. He came up sputtering. His family, those crazy bastards, all stood on the dock cheering and hollering. He swam the few feet back to the dock and reached a hand toward his wife.
"Scar, grab baby Joe."
His sister reacted without a second's hesitation, plucking Joe from Callie's arms. Before Callie knew what was happening, Gibson grabbed her and yanked her into the water with him. Callie came up laughing and splashed water at Gibson.
"You ass!"
He scooped her into his arms and then dunked them both, pressing a watery kiss to her mouth beneath the surface.
"Oh, what the hell?"
Bowie wrapped his arms around Cassidy, then leaned over the edge, toppling them both into the water. Next thing Gibson knew, people and dogs were jumping in around him. Scarlet passed Joe to Jenny, and with a whoop, she and Devlin plunged in. Their twins grabbed hands with Bowie and Cassidy's daughter and dove off the dock with a chorus of yells. Leah May recorded the shenanigans while Jameson took their girls' hands and jumped off the edge. Jonah pulled Shelby in with him, and their son dove in after them. George beat them all. He got a running start on the dock and cannonballed, sending a spray of water into the air. His daughter carefully removed her new jersey, folded it neatly, and then copied her dad with a big splash. June and their son emptied their pockets.
"This is a weird tradition, Mom," he said to her.
"Sometimes the best things don't make sense," June said, running a hand through his hair.
"Would you like me to push you in?"
"Nah, I've got it," he sighed and hopped feet first into the water.
June followed suit and swam out to George, who was floating on his back, spitting water at the sky like a fountain.
"Do you know how many units of urine are in a gallon of lake water?" June asked.
"Let's see if we've still got it," Shelby told Jonah.
"Come at me, Shelby, honey," Jonah said.
She swam to him, and he lifted her out of the water for a split second of dirty dancing perfection.
"Why do you guys always have to do that when we get in the water?"
their daughter groaned. Jenny laughed and handed baby Joe to Leah May.
"We'll go get towels."
It was a process to get everyone back on the dock. The big kids ran back to the house, followed by the dogs, dripping wet and shrieking about the cold ground. Jenny and Jimmy Bob brought armfuls of towels, and the parents helped their kids bundle up to go inside. Callie stood on the dock, her hair and clothes dripping. She and Gibson wrapped bright beach towels around their girls and sent them running inside to get dry by the fireplace.
"What are we going to do about clothes?" she asked, plucking at her sodden pajama pants.
He pulled her into his arms, feeling her body press against him.
"I packed an extra change of clothes for everyone in the back of the SUV in case there was another jello fight."
She draped her arms around his shoulders and tilted her face up so he could kiss her.
You are very good at this parenting thing, Gibson Bodine.
Merry Christmas, Callie Bodine,
he murmured between kisses. Merry Christmas, Gibson Bodine, she sighed happily. They walked back inside, arm in arm, to the chaos of a Bodine family Christmas. Ribbons and wrapping paper, food and drinks, wet dogs, laughing children, and happy adults. Gibson hugged Callie again, kissing her forehead.
Thanks, Mom and Dad,
he whispered to the framed photo on the mantel. He felt a lightness, a brightness, as if this moment was etching itself onto his heart. Rough edges sanded down with gratitude and forgiveness. This woman, this family, this life, it was all beyond his wildest dreams.
Where are they now? Judge Kendall is serving a life sentence in prison for, as the fine folks in Bootleg say, being a no-good, two-faced, incorrigible asshole. Misty Lynn followed in her mama's footsteps and ran off. She works part-time as a cashier in an adult video store and has been married and divorced 3 times. Her car was just repossessed. Henrietta Van Sickle reached enlightenment, cashed in the 7-figure stock portfolio no one knew she had, and moved to Blue Moon Bend. She winters in the Caribbean and started a scholarship fund for Bootleg Springs High School seniors interested in finance and world religions. Mona Lisa McNugget number 6 got herself into a love triangle with Rufus, the free-range goat, and Samson, the stray kitten. Jamie, the badass attorney, made partner in her firm and immediately implemented a hostile takeover, ousting the other 2 managing partners. She and her wife, Alice, are co-conspirators in a campaign to convince their teenage daughter that college, not bumming around Alaska and Europe for a year, is the better path to a successful future. Millie Waggles' baked goods finally snared her a man. Sid was on day 34 of keto when, weak with hunger, he wandered past her open window and ate an entire loaf of her cheddar cheese and rosemary bread. They honeymooned in Italy and ate all the carbs. Lula, spa entrepreneur and massage therapist, fell in love with a man with 4 daughters from a previous marriage. She is enjoying life as a not-so-evil stepmother. Old Judge Carwell and Carolina Ray finally retired and now run a canoe and kayak rental business on the lake. Mrs. Varney and old Jefferson Waverly finally came clean about their 20-year love affair. They tied the knot, but continue to live in separate homes. Sonny Fulson expanded Build-A-Shine to include a barbecue restaurant. He continues to guard the Moonshine Truth Serum recipe with his life. Opal Bodine met Billy Bodine on a blind date. Turns out he's a second cousin to the Bootleg Springs Bodines. When they tie the knot this fall, she will officially be a relation. The Making of Bootleg Springs. Once upon a time, 2 romance authors decided to write a series together. Neither of them really knew what they were doing, but they both thought it would be a heck of a good time. Spoiler! They were right. It started as random ideas thrown out in Messenger and text conversations. What should they write about? How would this work? There should be a town, right? Yes, definitely a town. And a family. That sounded good, too. How many books? 6. Why not? Lucy had this idea for a heroine, a sassy, beer-drinking, cowboy boot-wearing tomboy who wore a tool belt and drove a pickup. Where would she live? What kind of background would give rise to a girl like that? They said things like country, small town, quirky, boys who wear flannel and boots, a messy family with a complicated past, overbearing brothers. How many? Maybe 3. Wait, let's throw in another one they never knew. The town began to take shape. Founded by bootleggers with a fondness for being just outside the law. A place that makes its own rules, lives by its own code. Bootleg justice. where neighbors bring food by so they can get a peek inside, where gossip is a sport, and the best way to find out the latest news is to walk down the street. Everybody talks. And then, the characters. They needed six to start. Three brothers and a baby sister made four. The brother they'd never known was five. They knew from the start that the sister's best friend would be paired with a brother, so what if she had a sister and she got a book too? That made six. Perfect. They made name lists and started assigning them, brainstormed the family's backstory and what the kids were like. The firecracker little sister, the ultimate good guy, the quiet artist, the grumpy asshole. The sister's best friend and her sister, the quirky one that most people don't understand. The new in town brother they'd never known. Dividing them up turned out to be easy. Lucy had created Scarlet, so she went to her. She also wanted the good guy, Bowie, and the one they affectionately called new in town brother, until he had a name, Jonah. Claire had ideas for the shy artist, Jameson, the quirky sister, June, and the grumpy asshole, Gibson. And then, another what if. What if there was a town mystery? What if it ran through the whole series and each book had clues? What if the storylines were all connected to the mystery somehow? What if it's a missing girl? And what if she's the final heroine? Through more conversations, video chats, and brainstorms, Bootleg Springs was born. By the time Lucy started writing book one, they'd created the town, given it a touch of history, a bit of backstory, and the beginnings of the characters whose stories they'd tell, and thrown in a compelling mystery for good measure. Then the real magic happened. The stories came to life as Lucy and Claire each wrote their respective books. Lucy took 1, 3, and 5. Claire wrote 2, 4, and 6. There were more consultations and brainstorms. Secondary characters sprang to life, both animal and human. Bootleg Springs and its residents were no longer just a bunch of notes in a shared document. They read the first drafts of each other's books, offering feedback and doing their best to ensure consistency. They discussed the mystery and how it would play out in each story. They created clues, abandoned them, thought up new ones. As they say, the tale grew in the telling. And yes, they watched the readers, the theories and conjectures, the questions and discussions. And the biggest thing they both realized with each new book was that their readers were too effing smart. In the end, they wound up with a series that was a fantastic experience for both of them. They laughed a lot, learned a lot, cried a little, and cemented a friendship that they both cherish. Behind the scenes of Bootleg Springs. Lucy and Claire put together some more bonus and behind-the-scenes material for your enjoyment. They've included their theories on Henrietta Van Sickle, plus some peeks behind the scenes at text conversations and some of their original series notes. Who is Henrietta Van Sickle? Oftentimes, there is a lot of backstory that never makes it into a book. Lucy and Claire didn't have room for Henrietta, the town hermit's story, and never discussed their own theories on where she came from with each other. Here is what each of them had to say about the character. Lucy. Henrietta Van Sickle came to Bootleg Springs on a family vacation in 1977 with her three sisters, their husbands, and their 9 nieces and nephews. The kids never stopped talking. The adults never stopped yelling. 4 days into the trip, Henrietta had reached her limit. With just a backpack and her wallet, she abandoned the overcrowded lake house and took to the woods. She purchased a ramshackle cabin on the mountain, took a vow of silence, and managed her accounts via a post office box that she checked once a month. Using a pen name, she wrote 3 women's fiction books that went on to become bestsellers in the 80s. She quit writing when her publisher started making noises about a book tour and public appearances. Claire. With nothing but a single suitcase and big dreams, Henrietta Van Sickle boarded a bus on the outskirts of her tiny hometown, bound for New York City. An only child raised on a small farm, she'd always dreamed of big city life. The lights, the people, the sounds. Not long after she arrived, she got a job as a secretary in a swanky advertising and PR firm. She lived the city life for years, worked her way up until she was no longer taking notes and answering phones, but pitching ad campaigns to big clients. She went to cocktail parties, sipped martinis, wore expensive heels, and she talked. She talked, and she talked, and she talked. She talked to clients, made presentations, pitched new ideas to her bosses. She took phone calls in the evenings, talked to her chatty roommate and her many neighbors in her busy apartment building. She talked to people in stores and on the streets. Every day she was surrounded by people, crowds of people, huge skyscrapers full of people. One day she woke up and realized her dream of big city life hadn't been what she'd thought. She missed fresh air and flowers, trees, and snowy winters. She missed wide open spaces. And most of all, she missed silence. She quit her job, gave most of her possessions to her roommate, and got on a bus. Didn't even look to see where it was going. She rode that bus until it stopped in a place where the air was fresh, the trees were green, and the mountains sang with the promise of solitude. Once again, with only a single suitcase and big dreams, she got off a bus, this time in Bootleg Springs, West Virginia. Funny story about Mrs. Kendall. Not only did Mrs. Kendall not have a first name until book five, we also killed her off. Originally in Whiskey Chaser, we had her as recently deceased, but decided we had killed off enough parents and brought her back. Lucy missed one line of dialogue in Whiskey Chaser that referred to her being dead. It made it through to the originally published manuscript. Oops. It's a good thing she didn't stay dead, seeing as how she ended up being the bad guy and all. We were focusing on Judge Kendall until readers started predicting he was the reason Callie disappeared. Then we had the masterful idea to make her the even worse bad guy. Bootleg Springs, behind the scenes, author commentary. Snippets from text conversations between Lucy and Claire, in no particular order. Claire. So, seriously, I'm so in love with this book. It's the craziest thing to read characters I had a hand in and events and scenes we talked about, but it's not my words. Crazy in a good way. It's really fun. Claire, if we're writing first-person past tense, the first one. Lucy, is that what we're writing in? Claire, yes, I think so. Lucy, okay, good. The longer I think about it, the wronger everything sounds, so I need to not think about it. Lucy, did you make your Monday deadline? How have I not messaged you since Saturday? OMG, did we get into a fight that I don't remember and we're not speaking and the fate of Bootleg Springs is hanging in the balance? Claire, dot, dot, dot. Claire, remember that one time we were talking about all the stuff that needed to go into the last book and Mr. Lucy asked if I could do it in under 100,000 words? And I was like, oh yeah, I don't think it'll be that long. I was wrong. Lucy, thank God. You have no idea how that made me feel like I was writing bloated whale corpses instead of neat and tidy books. Claire, LMAO. And I look at your bloated whale corpse books and think, oh my God, my books are anemic and flat. Claire, oh, I have the best idea for how June and George meet for the first time. I can't wait to get started writing this book. Lucy, eep! Tell me! Claire, it involves things like hot springs, being naked, and June making awkward conversation about erections. Lucy, that's awesome. Claire, it should be pretty funny. Lucy, I have Cassidy and Scarlett dragging June to a party and she's sitting there reading the Wall Street Journal with a headlamp. She socialized for exactly 10 minutes, her deal with the girls. People are going to be so excited for June's story. Lucy, Binge Readers is currently trying to break me down and pump me for info on Bootleg Springs. Claire, ha ha ha, stay strong. Lucy,
What if no one ever gets as excited about anything else we write as they do about Bootleg Springs? Claire, no way, man. We're romance geniuses. Claire, I have another thought. Can we make the Gibson-Callie connection stronger? Like, what if it wasn't just a crush from afar? What if they were secretly together? It could have even been kind of innocent. Not like they were sleeping together, but she was sneaking around to see him. And he kept it from going too far because he was older and he didn't think he was good enough for her. Lucy. Thought about book 6. I think when Callie decides to tell Gibbs the story of how Jonah saved her, you could write it as a flashback. So the reader is getting everything kind of in real time. Like all her thoughts, how much pain she's in, what her feelings are toward her parents, how she feels about Gibson. I think it would be super powerful and goosebumpy. You could do a couple of flashbacks throughout since her escape is such a big story. Claire. Do we share a brain? Because I was absolutely going to do that. I think readers need to see it happen. Lucy. OMG, yas! Claire. Also, Gibson has a one-eyed dog named Cash. And he kind of sort of kidnaps someone, but not exactly. Cassidy isn't happy with him. Lucy. I love it. Lucy. OMG, that book, you killed it. I have such a book hangover from a beta read. Claire, I have so many effing feelings still. Lucy, jotting down ideas for the bonus epilogue and practically sobbing in the salon. Claire, aw, I know, this is so emotional. How are we going to say goodbye to these people? Claire, damn you and your bonus epilogue genius. I didn't get halfway down the first page before you made me cry. Lucy, I was stoically crying while I plotted it out. Bodine Family and Bootleg Springs, initial story notes. Here's a peek behind the curtain. This was some of what we came up with during all our brainstorming sessions. As you can see, some things changed, particularly in the beginning. We had ideas we didn't use, and a lot of ideas came to each of us while we wrote that aren't included here. The family. Mom and Dad got pregnant with Gibson, oldest, when they were teenagers, kind of blamed him for their lives never going anywhere. They have 4 children together, Gibson, Bowie, Jameson, and Scarlett. Dad had an affair when Gibson was young. This resulted in Jonah, a half-brother the Bodine family does not know about when the series begins. Mom died in what they believe was an accident. Is the real reason for her death related to the town mystery? Mom's death sent Dad into a spiral of self-destructive alcoholism. Jonah is named after his father. It's the one tie he has to his dad, but he doesn't realize he has siblings until he hears his father died. He reads the obituary and realizes he has siblings. That prompts him to come to Bootleg to find them. Scarlett drags Jonah into the family. Seriously, another fucking brother? Okay. Mom and Dad's relationship was volatile, but there were still lots of good times. They loved hard. Played hard, lived fully. Maybe there were big, loud arguments, but there was also a lot of love in the family. The brothers took it upon themselves to finish raising Scarlett. They're protective, smothering, of her, and she is not having it. The mystery. A girl went missing, and the mystery has never been solved. She was 16, and Scarlett was 14 at the time, so 12 years before the start of book 1. It's become a town pastime to speculate on what happened to her. A lot of people have theories, and maybe some are particularly outlandish. The reality is the girl was being abused by her father. Parents? Is her mom around? Dad Bodine was involved in sneaking her out of town to keep her safe, but he never told anyone. There will be clues to the mystery in each book, culminating in Mystery Girl returning to town. She's Gibson's heroine. In the first several books, it will become increasingly clear the dad and mom was involved, and the Bodine kids will fear he did something terrible. But in the end, they will learn he was instrumental in helping her get to safety, and she feels she owes him her life. Questions. Where did she go? Where did she do the rest of her growing up? Did she go live with extended family? Someone else? Why was it necessary to sneak her out and keep it a secret, especially since the town clearly noticed and has spent the ensuing years talking, speculating? Whoever took her in, it needs to make sense that they would and could keep her whereabouts a secret for so long. Part of the answer is that her dad is a prominent judge. What prompts her to return to Bootleg Springs? Where is her father, parents, now? Does she come home to confront him? Is he gone? Is she looking to reconnect with her past? She spent time in Blue Moon? Was she hurt severely and she needed reconstructive plastic surgery to correct a few things? It could have altered her appearance just enough that she's not recognized when she comes back to Bootleg Springs. Gibson will notice she knows her way around town, etc. The town. Annual festival that's boozy slash bootleg themed. Community softball games on Tuesday nights. Moonshine concession stands. Maybe different families have their own recipes and there's good-natured ribbing slash competition. School bus drives everyone home because they're too drunk to drive. Do any of the games actually go 9 innings? Wednesdays are known as Wasted Wednesdays because everyone is hungover. Chicken shit bingo, bonfires, lake parties, secret hot springs. Callie Kendall disappeared from Bootleg Springs 12 years before the start of Book 1. She was the daughter of Judge and Mrs. Kendall, who spent summers at their lake house in Bootleg but lived elsewhere during the rest of the year. Mrs. Kendall was abusive to Callie. She often made it appear that Callie harmed herself so she could blame the injuries on her daughter, self-harm. Judge Kendall didn't actively abuse them, but he covered up his wife's crazy and her abuse of their daughter for fear of what would happen to his career. He's not the direct abuser, but he's still a dick for letting his daughter be harmed and covering it up to save his career. Callie and Gibson had a secret friendship. Gibbs kept it platonic because he was 20 and she was 16, but they both loved music, so they'd sneak off together and play slash sing. The night Callie disappeared, she went home after spending the day at the lake with the teenagers of Bootleg. The mom beat her badly because they found out she'd been hanging out with Gibson. She fled and was heading to Gibson knowing he would help her. Jonas Sr. saw her on the way and stopped. He intervened because he knew his son would fly into a rage and probably kill the judge. He offered to take her somewhere safe for the night. She refused medical care of hospital as well as police. Jonah decided she was right because her dad's a judge, etc. Callie didn't tell the Bodines who had done this to her. They probably assumed her father, but she didn't say either way. She refused to tell. He took her to his granddad's old bootlegging cabin to hide her for the night. Then he and Mama Bodine, Connie, made plans to get Callie out of town. Jonah somehow got in contact with someone in Blue Moon. He was gone for a few days with an alternate explanation to his kids about where he was going. He took her either partway or all the way to Blue Moon, where a family was waiting to take her in, no questions asked. The alternate explanation was that his cousin in North Carolina had a flooded basement. He went there to help him fix it slash clean it up. He got a speeding ticket in New York State while he was away during this time. The Bodine kids find the ticket when cleaning out his house in Book 2. They notice the date and location and know it doesn't match the story about him going to North Carolina. Judge Kendall told the authorities that his daughter was depressed and suicidal. Maybe claimed they tried to get her help, but he and his wife fear that it was suicide. She was unstable. Jonah would have willfully ignored / kept away from Judge Kendall because he's the one who helped his daughter get out of town. Judge Kendall would have willfully ignored / kept away from Jonah Sr. because he killed his wife. So they never crossed paths or interacted after that. Callie sent periodic updates to Jonah Sr. in the form of postcards. Not often, and they wouldn't have identifying information on them. But she wanted him to know that she was still out there and doing fine. Postcards had song lyrics. Connie Bodine's accident. Connie Bodine died in a car accident about a year after Callie disappeared. The accident was immediately ruled an accident. She ran off the road and down an embankment. Sheriff Tucker thought it might have been suicide. There weren't brake marks on the road. He decided not to investigate it as such and rule it an accident. Whether? Because he didn't want to put the Bodine kids through finding out their mom killed herself. Progression of clues. Book 1. In Book 1, Callie Kendall is just the town mystery / obsession. Conspiracy theorists abound. Scarlett finds the cardigan Callie was wearing when she was last seen in a trunk of her parents' things. She takes it to the police, eventually, and the investigation is reopened, with Jonah Bodine Sr. as a person of interest. Book 2. In Book 2, Jameson is struggling with the increased scrutiny and gossip due to his father being a person of interest in the case. Jamie will meet with the siblings to tell them that no more evidence was found in their father's house and they're free to go inside it again. During the story, Jameson is going through his father's things, helping with the process because before they'd left it all to Scarlett, and he finds an old speeding ticket. The date is right after Callie disappeared. It's somewhere on the route to Blue Moon, which is north, and opposite of what the kids remember being told about where he was going. He brings it to his siblings because of the date. They all recall that, yeah, Dad did leave the night after Callie went missing. They remember being told he had to go to X location, but the speeding ticket is hundreds of miles in the opposite direction from there. They recall that he was out of town for a few days, and they wonder why he was north when they remember being told he'd gone somewhere south. Judge Kendall approaches the Bodines and tells them that he doesn't think their father was involved. He will keep up with the story that she was troubled or unstable. Gibson will growl at that a lot. He'll tell them he wishes they would just call off the investigation because it's so taxing on his poor wife. It's just dredging up old memories. He'll reiterate that their daughter suffered from depression, runs in the family on his wife's side, his wife has struggled for years, etc. The case also makes national news because Leah May is a celebrity model and was on a reality TV show. She's getting bad press for her antics on the show, largely faked by editing. Paparazzi come to bootleg when they find out where she is. This leads to pictures of her and Jameson together, which leads to the press digging into Jameson, which leads to it making national news that Leah is with a guy whose dead father is being investigated for the disappearance / possible murder of Callie Kendall. Gives national press to the whole story. This could be one of the things that prompts Callie / Maya to come back to bootleg. She can't let the man who saved her be accused of her murder. Book 3. Cassidy is pulled away from the investigation by Detective Connolly. He has disdain for small-town cops, thinks she shouldn't be working for her dad, etc. She's relegated to desk stuff and driving patrol. When she's scanning old case files to put them in the database, she discovers something that makes her want to look into Connie Bodine's car accident. Question: What is Cassidy doing when she looks into Connie Bodine's accident? Is she scanning files that are specific to the Callie Kendall case? Or is she just going through old files and scanning them and happens upon Connie Bodine's accident report? I ask because so far no one is connecting Connie Bodine's accident to the Callie case, at least not officially. Cassidy decides to track down Connie Bodine's car. It's still around. The junkyard guy is basically a hoarder who doesn't crush, get rid of stuff. So the car is there, and she brings Bowie with her when they look. They recover some things from the car. Mystery status at the end of book three. Connie Bodine's accident. What if... Since we changed the direct abuser from Judge Kendall to Mrs. Kendall... We need to make sure the Connie Bodine accident part still makes sense. Originally, we had Connie befriending Mrs. Kendall. Judge Kendall found out and had her killed. Option one. What if Connie Bodine didn't befriend Mrs. Kendall? What if the day she died, Connie did seek out Mrs. Kendall, but she didn't do so in friendship? Something prompted her to be angry and frustrated. Maybe it was an election year and the judge was up for re-election. Or she saw something in the newspaper about how great the Kendalls are. She didn't know the whole truth about Mrs. Kendall being the abuser and the judge covering it up, but she did assume that Callie's parents were the ones who hurt her, or at least the dad. So in her anger, maybe Scarlett comes by her spitfire nature, honestly? She drives her ass out to the hotel where Mrs. Kendall is involved in some kind of charity or political event. She confronts her afterward, saying she knows her husband hurt Callie, etc. Maybe she threatens to expose them, to tell the truth about what happened to Callie. We'd have to weigh Connie's motives here. She'd want to continue to protect Callie's whereabouts slash identity, but maybe she got angry enough that she decided something needed to be done. It could have been a big fight between her and Jonah Sr., and she left and did it anyway. In response, Mrs. Kendall follows her home and runs her off the road. Then the question would be, why didn't Mrs. Kendall go after Jonah? Probably a combination of the judge tightening the leash on his crazy wife a little bit and Jonah being a drunk anyway. They figure no one would believe anything he said anyway, which is basically what we talked about already as to why Connie was killed but Jonah wasn't. Option two. Connie Bodine believed that Judge Kendall had been the one to hurt Callie, and she assumed Mrs. Kendall was probably being abused too. She hated the idea that Callie's mother didn't know the truth, that her daughter was alive and well. Perhaps receiving one of the secret postcards prompted Connie to decide she had to tell Mrs. Kendall that her daughter was alive, mother to mother. Maybe Connie and Jonah still argued over this, but Connie went anyway. Spitfire, LOL. She could have seen something in the paper about the event Mrs. Kendall was going to be at, and she went there to talk to her. Maybe Mrs. Kendall played nice and acted amazed and grateful to have been told the truth about her daughter. Obviously, we won't know much about how this interaction went, since Connie is dead. But Connie told her that her daughter is alive and well, and she's doing okay. Mrs. Kendall doesn't want her daughter to be found. It's in her best interest if Callie is assumed dead, so she gets rid of Connie by running her off the road. Again, she doesn't kill Jonah, because maybe Judge Kendall tightens the leash and convinces her not to. He's a drunk, etc. Other potential clues. We didn't use a whole lot of these. Video. They watch an old family video. Jonah Sr. drunk slurs something about the judge. Money. They discover a large sum of money was taken out of Mrs. Kendall's account shortly after Callie disappeared. The assumption is that it might have been ransom money. It's suspicious because of the timing. Letter. A letter is found that's from Mrs. Kendall to Callie. It's kind of vague in that it isn't clear that it's a letter from a mother to a living daughter. It could say things like, I wish things had been different. This may or may not be necessary if Mrs. Kendall offers later clues. Something Jonah Jr.'s mom knows. Jonah's mom could tell Jonah something that Jonah Sr. said to her. He came to see her after Mama Bodine died. Maybe he told her something that she didn't understand then, but is relevant to the case. She tells Jonah Jr. Mrs. Kendall. Mrs. Kendall makes a scene in public. Judge Kendall walks her out, saying she's distraught. She suffers from depression, etc. After this, Judge Kendall has her committed to a mental hospital. This leads the Bodines to wonder what's up with her and want to talk to her about Callie. Someone goes to speak to her, but she doesn't appear to tell them anything coherent. Later, when the postcard is found and confirmed to be Callie's handwriting, they realize what Mrs. Kendall was trying to tell them, that Callie is alive. It makes sense now. Maybe she's also saying something that later they realize means Judge Kendall killed their mother? Postcard. Finding the postcard. Song lyrics on the back. Gibson says it's her handwriting. He proves it with a note she gave him. Won't explain why he has it. Postcard is given to police. Lawyer later tells them that it's Callie's handwriting. They now know she's alive. Maybe this leads to a conclusion of sorts, where the characters are happy that Jonah Sr. has been taken off the person of interest list and the case is no longer a murder case?
This has been Highball Rush, Bootleg Springs Book 6, written by Claire Kingsley with Lucy Score, narrated by Natalie Duke and Stephen Dexter. Copyright 2019 by Always Have LLC. Production copyright 2020 by Always Have LLC.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.